Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City, friends. Yep, here at NOLA Drinks, we are sure glad a dude named Robert doesn't want to talk to us. Got a good show for you today, friends. As always, at least I like to think we always have a good show for you. Sometimes maybe a little hit or miss, but this is a good one. And a couple great sets of interviews. First off, we talked to Shane Finkelstein, as well as Orestes Montero Cruz. Shane is the producer of Top Taco New Orleans, an event that is now coming into its second year, taking place on Thursday, March 15th, 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock at Waldenburg Park. There's a VIP hour that goes on at 6. The event last year, it was the first year of the event, as you may surmise, took place at Spanish Plaza, so they're moving on down the river to a bigger spot there at Waldenburg Park, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a great competition that involves Top Taco tacos, as you can imagine, as well as agave-based cocktails. So generally, we're looking, of course, at tequila and mezcal, and they do sort of margaritas. There's traditional, non-traditional, both in the drinks category as well as the food category. So we pay a visit over to Casa Bodega, where Orestes is the bar manager, also the son of the family that owns it, and Shane, of course, who, as I mentioned, is producing Top Taco, and we talk about the event, and it's really cool. Looking forward to it. One of the things that they're doing that we get into also, the event is expanding from just the one evening to kicking off the Sunday before with a brunch and a whole week's worth of activities, dinners, happy hours, an industry set of events going on called Agave Week, and it's going to be focused again on spirits there. So that should be really, really fun. Check out toptaconola.com and listen to that interview. And then we move over for the second week in a row. We go back to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And this whole thing was done on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard within about 2.5 blocks apart. And that's where Casa Bodega is, and that's where the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is, both there in Central City here in New Orleans, of course. And really cool. If you haven't been down that way, just a side note here, if you haven't been down that way in a while, there's some really cool stuff. There's some cool shops there, some cool places to eat, some music going on these days. And there was an exhibit, I believe, that was at Tulane originally placed there in 2015, talking about the history of Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard and its history going way back. But it's a very important place in history in New Orleans, and has a very important place in New Orleans history as it relates in particular to African Americans in the city. And if you walk around, some of the storefronts there have panels that were originally at that Tulane exhibit talking about the history and some other things that are going on in the neighborhood. And just really worth a stroll if you get a chance to go down there if you haven't been there in a while. But as I said, we moved to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and we talked to Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria Project, which is a food policy project, and that's part of connected to the museum. The museum is under the umbrella of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and so Pepper is based here. She is the director of the program, and that is in the Center for Food Law, Policy, and Culture. And again, it is about food policy. Pepper is a wealth of information and a really fun person to talk to, and so we have a conversation with her about food policy. We are going to be having Pepper on a fairly regular basis, and one thing that I wanted to mention, friends, here this evening, she gives a lot of talks, and she's giving a talk. I think it's a fascinating one this evening. It's taking place 5:30 p.m. at the Community Bookstore, which is on Bayou Road. Don't have the address, I apologize, in front of me, but that's easily found. Again, Community Bookstore on Bayou Road at 5:30. And she's talking about food policy, but this is part of a broader forum, and it's called Southern Struggle, which is the first political education forum hosted in collaboration by DSA People of Color Caucus and DSA Political Education Committee. And the series discusses things on the radical history of Southerners of color. So topics are including Black agriculture, education for children of color in New Orleans, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and the history of communism among Black Southerners in the pre-civil rights era. So some really interesting topics. What Pepper is going to be talking about, as you might gather, is food policy. And she sent me some notes on her talk this evening, which looks great. And I believe she's going to be focusing on talking about food policy trends and patterns as it relates to African Americans in the South moving forward from the Civil War. And so I think talking about some of the disconnect that happened with food is people, many African Americans fled the South, moved north, how these patterns affected how people ate, where they got their food. You know, obviously when you move to an urban environment, farming becomes different or very difficult. And so access to food, those patterns change, as well as talking about, for example, when people moved into tenements, they were put together so that, you know, basically you're sort of subdividing and subdividing and subdividing to get more people into, you know, a small space. And what happened is kitchens were eliminated in a lot of these cases. And as they were eliminated, then people that took another way away of people and their ability to eat food. And so how these patterns kind of emerged after the Civil War and even where we kind of are today. So I encourage you to go check out Pepper's talk. She is also going to be starting a podcast, which is going to be basically put through the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and it's going to be called Green Pepper. There you go. Her name is Pepper Bowen, and she's going to be talking about Culinaria Month is going on. It's the 10th anniversary of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and February is Culinaria Month, so that's when she's launching her podcast in the middle of February, talking about food policy, but it's woven in with culture and history and all of kinds of wonderful stuff. So we'll be sure to share that. We're going to have Pepper on a little bit later in February, talking about the podcast and some other topics in food policy and all of that good stuff. So check that out. And that's who we talked to in the second hour today. Friends, wanted to mention a couple events coming up this weekend. Of course, the famed Crew de Vue parade, kind of the first, you know, big parade as we roll into Mardi Gras. I guess we can call it big parade. But, you know, that's to me where I really look where things get going here as we are in carnival season. And that's taking place this Saturday, as I said, 6:30. Pardon me. Let's hope the weather holds out. The weather forecast is not looking great. But let's just, you know, hopefully that rain gets here and gets out of here before they start the parade at 6:30. Starts up there in the Marigny and wends its way kind of through the Marigny a little bit, comes up into the quarter, wends its way through the quarter, and ends up there right more or less by Café du Monde, kind of in that area, if I'm not mistaken. And a little bit past that by Jackson Square. So a block or so past that. There you go. Right. But you can go check out the Crew de Vue website. It is a Crew, K, of course, K-R-E-W-E-D-U-V-I-E-U-X.com, and they have the route there, so check that out. That's always a fun parade. Very irreverent, very adult only. The theme this year is Bienville's Wet Dream. Okay, I'm just going to leave that at that. If you know it, that you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. Okay, so there you go. But you know, leave the kids at home. Get a babysitter. Go check that out. Get yourself some adult beverages. It is a funny, funny satirical parade, so be sure to check that out. This Monday, friends, another really cool event coming up here. It is an all-female charity bartending competition taking place. It's called Speed Rack. We're going to leave that there, too. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. It's a speed competition. And these very talented bartenders come from all over the country, all females, to compete in a contest. And the structure is really neat. There's a preliminary round where they're given a possible set of cocktails, and then they're told to do four, and they have to set, they get about 2 minutes to set up their well, and then they race to put all these drinks together, and they have to be done right, and they have to be presented right, and they have to be done quickly. So they're, you know, basically simultaneously making four drinks, trying to figure out shared ingredients, how that goes. Really, really a lot of fun. Some of the bartenders that are participating are some of the best around the country. I went to a practice yesterday for the representation, the delegation from New Orleans. Some of my very favorite bartenders in town, some of the most talented bartenders in town, are going to be participating. And that was really cool to check that out. That was at Canaan Table yesterday. So thanks to them for inviting me. It was really fun to watch. They kind of explained to me how the structure is going to work. But this event is coming up, friends, on Monday, this Monday, that's right, January 29th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Howlin' Wolf, which is at 907 South Peter Street. The important thing, too, is that, you know, it's an all-female bartending competition, as I said, but it is a fundraiser for breast cancer research and awareness. So it goes for a great cause. Tickets are $25 in advance or $30 at the door. All of the product has been donated, so I believe that includes your drinks. While you're there, go check out speedrack.com. That's speed-rack.com for more information, and I believe links to tickets. You can also get on social media, hashtag backtherack and hashtag Speed Rack NOLA. Good event. Okay, friends, go check that out. Be sure to be supportive. I know it's 3 to 7 on a Monday. Might be a little tough, but hey, after you knock off work, go check it out. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We are going to be back chatting with Shane and Orestes about Top Taco. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to be chatting with Pepper Bowen of Culinaria, as I mentioned. So hey, stick around and come on back. Swing for me on a Mardi Gras day. Sunday, swing, I say. Swing for me on a Mardi Gras day.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickey Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land wherever you may be. Thanks, friends, for tuning in today. I appreciate it. Yes, we are sitting here at Casa Barrega Restaurant on Aretha Castle Haley here in New Orleans, and we are sitting here with Shane Finkelstein and Orestes Montero Cruz, and we're going to talk about, we'll talk a bit about Casa Barrega, of course, but we're also going to talk about a great event coming up, the second annual Top Taco NOLA. Shane, congratulations on surviving another year, man, and it's getting bigger this year.
It is getting bigger. We're quite proud of the event. It's for a worthy cause, One Heart NOLA, which helps foster kids in the city. And we're expecting it to be a bigger and better event this year in a new location at Waldenburg Park, right along the river. And we're going to have our VIP paddle wheeler Creole Queen again.
And, cool. Yeah. That, you know, so last year was the inaugural year, and it was a terrific success. It was at Spanish Plaza, and you, excuse me, had about 3,000 people, which for a first time event's great. So you need more real estate, right? Moving.
Well, we have more sponsors this year as well. We added about 10 more tequilas this year. We added Camellia Beans as a sponsor. We have Pepsi as a sponsor. That means more tents and more space. Requirements.
Well, let's talk a little bit too about the, obviously the One Heart NOLA cause for foster kids is great, but what prompted you to want to bring this event to New Orleans last year and then continue it this year?
Well, I love tacos and tequila. I'm really passionate about them. I've always have been. It's something that, you know, we've added a lot of really great new Latin restaurants in New Orleans. We're seeing a lot higher tequila sales in this city. Tequila and tacos are exploding all over the country. I wanted to put a spotlight on the industries and what we're doing down here, and I thought this was the best way to do it. I had some friends in Denver that produced Top Taco in Denver, and it was a very successful event, and I asked them if they would help me do it here, and I knew it would be a big hit.
Great, and it was. And let me ask you this question, Orestes. So, Orestes, you're the bar manager here and also the son of the owner at Casa Barrega. And something that Shane just mentioned I think is interesting. Now, you guys are one of the important, noted Mexican restaurants here in New Orleans. Is it good to have there's a better representation of Mexican food here in town now, isn't there, along with you guys?
Thank you, Brian. Yes, definitely our interest when we founded Casa Barrega was to bring more of our traditions and roots here to this amazing city. And definitely now there's a lot of panorama in Mexican food happening here in the city, but we consider that we are an important part of this scene.
Yeah, and it's a growing scene. How long has the restaurant been here?
Now it's 4 years.
About 4 years. That's great. One of the things, too, aside from, so we're talking about, you know, Mexican food, and I think we're starting to see more higher-end Mexican food come into town, which is not necessarily what we're here to talk about today, but a component, of course, is enjoying agave-based distillates, tequila and mezcal by name. And you're adding, Shane, this year, an agave week. We're going long on the days with agave, which I greatly appreciate, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I know it takes a lot of effort and expense to be a part of Top Taco, and I really, as a restaurateur myself at Nacho Mama's, I decided that I really wanted to give as much value to the restaurants that were participating in Top Taco, and I also wanted to give as much value to the spirits for donating the product and donating to our cause. So I came up with the idea to create a week of events leading up to Top Taco that really focused on tequila and mezcal. And, you know, I gave it a name of Agave Week. It's not being done anywhere else in the country. Nowhere else in the country is there an Agave Week.
You did the legal check on all that?
Well, there's an Agave Heritage Week in Tucson, right. But, you know, no one's taken my name yet. So, you know, I'm giving it, you know, a cohesive event, and we've got some really cool events lined up for it, and everybody seems to really be buying into the idea.
That's great. And we have a couple more segments after this, you guys, to talk. So we'll get into some, we're going to go through some of the specific events that you're doing for Agave Week as well as Top Taco itself. But Reces, let me ask you this question. I think we would both agree on this, that having, not only is it important to have the Mexican cuisine here, but having that pair with a quality agave, quality tequila, quality mezcal program is critically important.
Definitely. Yes. All our cuisine is based on an ingredients that definitely gets a better flavor, and you have a better experience with their paired with agave spirit, specifically the ones that are 100% agave azul that sometimes people don't know about tequila denomination, and definitely right now the mezcal and all the agave spirits that are going on.
Now, Shane, I know running Nacho Mama's, you're in the Elmwood area, correct?
Is that correct?
Yeah. We're seeing more quality agave distillates, better tequila, better mezcal coming into the market now, aren't we, here in New Orleans?
Oh, yeah. And we have a much bigger selection than we used to. We're still, you know, about a quarter of what they have in Denver or, you know, some of San Diego, other cities. But yes, you know, we're seeing new ones in the market now, you know, often. We even have a launch party for a new tequila for Agave Week. So, yeah, the selection is definitely a lot better than it used to be. We're still far behind on the mezcals, but tequilas, I think we're starting to catch up.
Yeah, and even the mezcal, I think if we go back 4 or 5 years, probably 2 or 3 brands on the market in New Orleans, right? Del Maguey, Vago maybe, one or two others, and that's it. And so now I think we probably have about 20 or so, don't we? Is that right?
Yes. But
I says, how many do you have here?
We have around 25 brands right now, we have also like seasonal products that, you know, we have like special flights every weekend that we try to promote seasonal products.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, Shane, has this with the uptick in both on the food side as well as the agave beverage side, has this made it easier to attract people from the producer side and the restaurant side to the event?
Well, we had an advantage by having the successful event in Denver. So we did have brands that jumped in with us year one. But this year, after we proved ourselves last year, we have a lot of new brands that are really supportive of what we're doing. You know, we're really just teaching people the differences between the brands. And, you know, if you're a brand that's coming out to Top Taco, you've got a quality tequila. You're not, you know, every brand that's in Top Taco is 100% blue agave.
Yeah, sure.
I said that. I started thinking, wait a second.
I think it's true.
So, uh-huh. And you know, the restaurants and bars that are participating are also some serious tequila and mezcal aficionados. So
right now, it's an interesting mix, I think, too, of restaurants, because it's certainly a certain number of traditional Mexican restaurants that are participating. But then there's always some interesting ones where you go, man, they make a taco. I had no idea they make a taco, and they maybe do just for the event.
Yeah, well, they don't have to. That was the whole idea. Is even last year, we had on our VIP places that don't do tacos. We want people to realize that, you know, you can put anything in a corn or flour tortilla, and it'll be delicious. Actually, in Denver, I went to the Top Taco this year, and the best one I had there was an Indian curry taco. It was outstanding.
That sounds excellent.
It was. It was great. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Redfish Grill and Sobu, they actually do have tacos on their menu. And I think they're you know, trying to spotlight that. But you don't have to. Our VIP this year has some really cool restaurants as well that don't do tacos.
Yeah, there was some. I remember somebody did a very New Orleans. They did a red gravy taco, which was great. And I was in the VIP area.
And some of the restaurants here, you know, in town are really marrying, you know, the Creole flavors with Mexican flavors. So, you know, that's pretty interesting to see. Even like a place like Juan's, they build themselves as a Creole taqueria.
Are they participating?
Will
Juan's be out there?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Well, you guys, let's do this. We're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about the specifics of the event. There's great entertainment. There's all kinds of great stuff that goes on at the main event, Top Taco, that's going to be taking place. But then there's also, as we mentioned, all the stuff going on with Agave Week, and we're going to get into some of the specifics and how you can participate, not only at Top Taco, but also participate in some of the special dinners and educational events that they're putting on. So we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, and we'll be right back. Come on back.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. We are chatting with Shane Finkelstein, who is not only the proprietor of Nacho Mama's Mexican restaurant in Elmwood, but also the organizer, executive director. What's the correct grand poobah?
Producer,
okay, of Top Taco, the second annual event coming up. And Orestes, I apologize. Montero Cruz. I apologize, Orestes. Orestes is the bar manager and also son of the owner here at Casa Bodega. Apologies.
Disculpa.
We're talking a little bit about Top Talk, and we're talking about, as we left off, guys, we talked a bit about some of the non-traditional restaurants participating. And you guys, I think, handle it in a neat way. So there's a judging that goes on for both the food and the drink, and you kind of break it up in two interesting ways to sort of accommodate the traditional versus the non-traditional.
Yeah, we do. We have fan voting and judges voting. So everybody that enters the event will get four voting chips, and we have four categories. We have top taco, top traditional taco. We have top creative taco. Then we have top traditional margarita and top creative tequila cocktail. And that's, you know, we really want some outside the box drinks in that category.
Right. And there were a lot of interesting representations last year, both on the traditional and the non-traditional side. And I remember one of the conversations having you had kindly asked me to be a judge last year of that part of the competition on the cocktail side. And we, you know, kind of started really geeking on agave cocktails. And now we started talking about, okay, because we had the Paloma and a lot of people were making Paloma variations. And we're saying, well, is that traditional or is that not traditional? So there's a lot of variety out there. And so by opening up a non-traditional for the food and the cocktail, you open up some different avenues.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed. Not that Mazzotto won, but that they won, with a strawberry basil creative cocktail, because that wasn't very creative to me.
Right.
But I heard it was delicious. So, you know, I guess taste won out in that one.
You know, and you do a people's choice, right? And then you have judges, and it's interesting to see how those line up.
Yeah,
actually,
they came in first in the fan voting and second in the judges voting. So that cocktail must have been pretty good. But the on the taco side, Chilango's won for top traditional taco on both fan and judges voting. So that was quite impressive.
They did really well. And we were talking before we went on the air about that. That's a neat family-run restaurant out in Kenner. And I think a lot of people were surprised that they won.
Yeah, they were surprised they won. A lot of people never even heard of the place. And they beat all the top restaurateurs that are and chefs that are in our event. So, you know, we were very happy for them. That was really turned out something special. And, you know, for those that don't know, the owner of Chilango's passed away this year, and we've decided to honor him by making the award for the ultimate top taco trophy is now called the David Montez de Aca Ultimate Top Taco.
Oh, that's cool. That's great. And it's a nice family. They decided to carry on the tradition to continue to run the restaurant. Super solid karaoke out there on Friday and Saturday nights in Kenner. Highly recommend that. So, Shane, going forward, aside from the Top Taco event, this whole Agave Week, you have all kinds of cool stuff planned, some dinners, some educational stuff. Tell people, when is Top Taco? Let's start.
Top Taco is Thursday night, March 15th, from 7 to 10. We also have a 6 o'clock VIP hour, VIP and first tasting. You can find out more information about it at toptaconola.com, and you can purchase your tickets directly on there. And all ticket pricing includes unlimited gourmet tacos, cocktails, beer, wine, water, soft drink, entertainment. It's all included. You don't have to spend a dime once you get in.
That's a great deal. And we'll make sure we circle back on that information where you can get tickets to the different events, see more on the events, and there'll certainly be links on the show's social media and on our website to that. So let's roll back. So Thursday is the main event, Top Taco, on March 15th. But we're kicking things off a few days before that.
We're kicking things off. This is a pretty cool idea. We're going to do the world's largest Bloody Maria brunch. I think someplace in Minnesota has the record right now, so we're going to try to top
Wait, Minnesota?
I think so.
Okay, after the football a couple weeks ago and Minnesota, I'm just saying, okay, we're taking that away.
Yeah, we can take that away easy. I think we can come up with at least 60 accoutrements for a Bloody Maria.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sponsored by Milagro, and it's at Superior Grill. We're going to do it over the brunch, 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock. I think it's going to be a really cool event. Let people build their own Bloody Marys and have a little kickoff party for Agave Week.
This is going to be a great way to go out and get revenge for the Saints-Vikings loss. It's come correct. Out and beat them in the Bloody Maria competition, right?
Yes, yes.
So that's Sunday yep. brunch at Superior
and then
Grill.
Then we have some more serious events. We have a mezcal event, a mezcal mashup with Cure and Cane and Table with excellent Del Maguey mezcal on Sunday night. On Monday night, we have a dinner, an agave dinner, a five-course Oaxacan dinner at Casa Borrega, at our friends here at Casa Borrega. Tuesday, we have a launch party for Blue Nectar, a new tequila in town at Baru. On Wednesday, we have an agave seminar and panel discussion for the brand for the industry professionals and a few cocktail enthusiasts to learn more about tequila and mezcal. On Wednesday night, Wednesday afternoon, we have a happy hour at with Religion Tequila at Del Fuego, mm-hmm. and we have followed by a ghost party at Tequila House.
Yeah, Tequila House on Bourbon Street.
And then
okay.
we have another agave dinner at Caribbean Room with El Tesoro.
That's great. So let's circle back on a couple of these events, just to kind of use them as examples. Let's do this. Let's talk about the educational stuff and the panel stuff, and then we're going to take a break after that, and we'll come back and we'll talk about the dinner here at Casa Borrega with Orestes. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always felt like New Orleans was a little behind or a lot behind in the educational side of the agave spirit. You know, a lot of people just know one or two brands. They don't really know the differences between the brands. They don't really know the differences in the flavor profiles between a silver and a reposado and a añejo. They don't know the you know,
the
what
production
goes into
process,
distilling
right?
it. The whole mm-hmm. process. So we decided to invite the El Tesoro brand to do a virtual reality agave seminar. It's a wonderful event. I went to it before myself. I thought it was really impressive. I really learned a lot from it. We have that, we're going to do that in addition to a couple of spirit pairings. You're going to taste some of the spirits. You're going to get to try some of the tequilas out, most of the ones that are in Top Taco. And after the lunch, we're going to provide lunch. And then after lunch, we're going to have a panel discussion where you get to, you know, learn a little bit from the brand ambassadors and distillers that are involved in Top Taco.
That's going to be great. And that's at the Audubon Aquarium, correct?
Yeah, that'll be at the aquarium on Wednesday early in the day.
That's great. And so we'll make sure that we share information in regards to that, guys. So if you're in the industry and you want to inquire about that, that'll be really fascinating stuff. So with all the events and how you're working them, Shane, I know it's a challenge to put these things on. People have been pretty enthusiastic, the brands and the restaurants to host as you expand this out?
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, some of them are. Some of them are okay with, you know, not doing anything. But the ones that are into doing an additional event seem really excited about the opportunity. The brands definitely are excited about building on the partnerships that they're creating with their restaurant partners. And that's an important part of this whole thing. A lot of events that are in town, they're really just, you know, one-day events, you know, where a brand comes out and, you know, they're giving a lot of product away for their generosity and donation, which is nice of them, but they're not getting that 6-week program that they or you know, a long-term relationship out of it, and we're providing that for them.
I think that's an important thing, is it's allowing a situation for people to connect, for the brand to connect better with people, both the people who sell it and the people who are going to consume it in a dedicated aficionado sort of way. Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take another break here on the show. We're going to come back, talk maybe a little bit more about that stuff, and then we're going to chat a little bit just to kind of give you a flavor, if you will, about the dinner that's going to take place here at Casa Borrega during Agave Week leading up to Top Taco on Thursday, March 15th, Waldenburg Park. Friends, take a little break here on the show. Come on back.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Syrah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are here at Casa Borrega on Aretha Castle Haley here in New Orleans. And we are chatting with Orestes Montero Cruz, who is the beverage director here, bar manager here, and also a family member of the ownership, and Shane Finkelstein, who is the producer of Top Taco. And as we left the segment, guys, last time, we were talking about the brands and being able to connect with people in a more meaningful way, both their accounts as well as for the enthusiasts, the consumers themselves. And I think as we're seeing an uptick in more agave and better quality agave is probably a better way to put it on the market, I'm assuming that some of the venues are really excited because we do a lot of wine dinners here in this town, for example, and a lot of them are not very well done. This is something new, and I'm going to guess that there's some enthusiasm behind the novel aspect of it.
Yeah. You know, Tales of the Cocktail created the spirited dinner, and it's a really good idea for people to really understand the different uses for the different spirits. How much variety of, you're not going to get five margaritas at Casa Borrega Spirit agave dinner. You're going to get, a couple of classic cocktails and just with tequila instead of vodka or instead of whiskey. You know, you're going to get a tequila-based cocktail that, I think a lot of people are think of tequila and margaritas, and sweet and sour, but there's so many other ways that you can go with a tequila cocktail.
We know just even in Restas, we know this, that the classic presentation of traditional margarita is tequila, sugar, and lime, and that really allows the expression of the tequila, the quality of the distillate to show through, right?
Yes, correct. Yes, but as Shane was saying, I think definitely it's important an education from the people here in New Orleans, not only in the drinks, but also and food wise, especially in the Mexican area, because we love Tex-Mex here, and people are used to more a Tex-Mex side of the food, and when you present spices that comes from Mexico, epazote, that is very important for us, and you don't understand that they have to be paired with something that comes from Mexico too. In this case, with a tequila, the silver allows expressions of, you know.
So very, very clean, non-aged tequila, right?
Yes, it's straightforward and it's perfect as an aperitif, you know, to start and just to refresh your palate. And then Reposado allows another combinations with the spices like mole that we prepare the mole from zero, from scratch.
So the reposado going with the mole, some of the spicier notes and the smokier wooded notes on the reposado are going to pair nicely with the mole, correct?
Exactly. And also, like, well, you know, like the chipotle chicken, for example, with refreshing cocktails and different herbs, it allows, like, to get really interesting notes, and it's simply delicious. But yeah, this is a great opportunity to, you know, educate people also how to not to go out of the box with Mexican food, you know, like to get a little bit more of the, it's I know that it's a word used a lot, authentic food, but mm-hmm. you know, getting close to the roots.
Showing some people some different things that maybe they're not just going to see at a gringo taqueria somewhere, right?
Correct.
And I think and one of the things that you said, Orestes, and I like the approach here, is using the dinner, and this is sort of where I was going with that about the wine dinner presentation, is using the opportunity to actually teach somebody something or show somebody something. And I think that very often at times these dinners are very rote, color by numbers. This is creates an opportunity to be creative. You guys are doing a 5-course Oaxacan style or Oaxacan influence meal here, correct, Orestes?
Yes, Oaxaca is one of the most important states in Mexico. It's one of my favorites to visit when I'm over there, and especially the food is amazing. It's just like so diverse, and it has like an eclectic combination of flavors. So it's very interesting to play around. Or chef is from Mexico City, but she has family from Oaxaca, so that allows her to play with the flavors and present it in a unique way.
Now, will you sit down with her as you go through the menu, work up the cocktails, and work back and forth, share some ingredients, that kind of thing?
Definitely. It's always like a process of, going back and forth, because actually the kitchen is really close to the bar here. So we're in a small restaurant, which we're proud, because we give more like that cozy feeling of about like a Mexican experience. It's not only, you know, like coming for food, it's the whole experience. So, yeah, we work close with the kitchen.
That's great. Awesome. That's a great dinner. So let's remind people, when is that dinner again for here at Casa Bodega?
Yes. So it will be on Monday, the
11th.
The 11th. I'm sorry. Yeah. Monday, the 11th. We usually are closed first for Mondays, but since it's the Agave Week, we're going to be gladly being part of it, and we're excited about this event.
Limited seating, right, you guys?
So limited seating.
$75, 5 courses. Don't miss out.
All the information, casaborega.com, and also info@casaborega.com.
Okay, great. Shane, we didn't really talk about this at Top Taco at the main event. Great music. You got some really good bands, man.
Yeah, well, I think we got the best Latin bands around New Orleans. There aren't a whole lot of them, but we got our Margie Perez and her awesome band Movuelo. Was in our VIP last year. They're moving out onto the main stage. They're going to be followed by Otra, who is a wonderful Latin band, salsa band. And we also have Los Poboicitos. And it's going to be in the Luna Azul tent. And the VIP one is not announced yet. We're going to have a pretty cool band in the VIP as well.
That's cool. That'll be really fun. So a lot of great entertainment, you guys, connected to the event as well. How much are tickets for Top Taco?
Tickets start at $65 for general admission, $85 for first tasting, which gets you in an hour early, $125 for the VIP experience aboard the Paddle Wheeler Creole Queen, which will be really special this year. We have an extra añejo tequila tasting station. We have a dessert station. We have 7 restaurants doing their own take on tacos that don't normally do tacos, from everywhere from Manning's to Flamingo Agogo to Ugly Dog Saloon. We've got a bunch of restaurants in the Warehouse District because we're going to do a margarita mix-off with those restaurants to see who can make the best margarita, and we're going to feature those margaritas on the VIP as well.
That's great. And all the events then, the dinners and such that we're talking about, those are individually priced, and all of that is on toptaconola.com. Is that correct?
Well, some of them, yeah. Some of them are invitation only. Some of them are free events, and some of them are for sale events. So you just need to check it all out. There's a link on our toptaconola.com website. And pick and choose which ones you want to attend or which ones are open to the public. And come out and support a great spirit and great restaurants. And
a great charity. So mention that again.
And a great
charity,
yeah. One Heart NOLA, which works with foster kids in the city. Specifically, they like help out kids that age out of the foster system. In Louisiana, they age out at 18. A lot of other states, it's 21. And their goal is to keep these kids in school, keep them off the streets, keep them in beds with a roof over their heads.
That is a really important cause, and especially here in the state of Louisiana. So I thank you all for doing that. Really quickly, Orestes, tell people the address here, the street address of Casa Bodega.
Yes, it's 1719 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. This is in Central City, New Orleans, zip code 70113.
Great, and you guys are open when?
We're open from Tuesday through Sunday. Sunday, it's only brunch, so it's only open until 3, but the rest of the day is 11 to 11.
Great. And a great agave selection, good tequila, good mezcal, good food, and live music here too every once in a while. You guys, thanks very much for taking time out, Shane. We'll hit this up again before the event, of course, and all of that good stuff.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Friends, that was Shane Finkelstein, producer of Top Taco, as well as Orestes. And I'm going to do it again. Orestes Montero Cruz, who is the bar manager here at Casa Bodega. Come check out Top Taco, you guys, and come check out Casa Bodega. We're going to take a little break on the show, friends. Come on back.
For a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails, Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. As always, friends, thanks for tuning into the show here today. Happy day to you, whether you're listening on Thursday here on the radio in New Orleans or some other time to the podcast down the road, wherever you're at. I really appreciate it. Please to make a repeat visit to one of my favorite locations now here in the city, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And this time, last week I was joined by Jill Benson, their director of culinary programming. And this time I'm pleased to be joined by my new friend, Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria Program as part of the Food Law and Food Law Policy and Culture Center. Is that?
Perfect.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Awesome. And so we're going to talk a little bit today about food policy, your background, some other things. Here's the important question that I have to ask you, because you're working in food policy.
Yes.
And your name is Pepper. How did that happen?
Okay, so the name Pepper actually preceded food policy, and it was, which is good, because otherwise it would be rather self-serving. But I can honestly say that it was not a compliment necessarily. It came from being difficult to deal with.
Ah, peppery. So, okay, I got
yes,
it.
Yes, a little spicy, I was told, which and is a Southern way of saying, please stop, by please God. Stop.
So were you anointed this by your folks?
No,
neighbors.
No, I wish it was something that I got in childhood, and then I just never grew out of, or worse than that, it was something that stuck, right? And so I couldn't shake it. No, I was an adult. I was an adult. I was working with doctors, and we would have none of their tomfoolery. So.
Oh, that's good though. I like that. Well, that would be a badge of honor. I think actually being called Pepper by a bunch of doctors. That's fantastic.
So it was actually, I used to work in IT, and there was a guy who came from marketing, and he was working in IT on our view through the healthcare system. And we were doing a number of conversions together, and again, very staunch in my position as a project manager. You do need that as a quality. Some call it stubborn, but I prefer to think of it as determined.
How about advocacy?
Yes.
Okay.
See, and so there we are. I was advocating for my point and my point only. And so I was given the moniker.
I like it. That's a great story, and I like it better because it came from a bunch of doctors. So, yeah, call me sandpaper, whatever you want. That's just fine. That's great. So, Pepper, tell us a little bit more about your background and how you found your way. I mean, you mentioned a little bit, but how did you find your way into the world of food policy?
So, I brought my life down to the studs and went back to law school in 2012 with the expectation that I would be going into immigration. And when I got there, I found out that immigration is family law across international waters, and I did not have the stomach or the heart for it. So after working in IT for a number of years, we won't share, I used one of the tried and true ideas that folks in business say that, if you find the thing that you love, you'll never work again, right? And so of the things that I would do for free and happened to have been around food. So I read cookbooks as my choice of leisurely reading. I get the only magazines I get are either food or beverage inspired. And for fun, I eat.
Yes. I like it. That's now
you, I get so excited about that.
That makes all the sense in the world. That makes all the sense in the world. It's great. And I mean, and not only do you eat for fun, and we were talking about this too. We'll talk about this probably on a future show for certain, if not, about, our love and joy of eating in New Orleans. It's not survival.
It is
in and
not.
Of itself.
It's not. Food should not be about just surviving. Food should be about living.
Yes.
It should be that catalyst. It's that thing that you talk about over lunch, what you're having for dinner, where you had it yesterday. It should be a way to share. And truth be told, part of Culinaria's mission is to help people understand that culture, your culture, my culture, everybody's culture is passed to them on a plate. So whatever it is that you eat, wherever it is that you're from, all of those things that you know about yourself come to you through the plate.
That's a great point. I think a lot of people probably presumably listening to this show, if it's just because you're from New Orleans and you're listening on the radio, or if you're listening to the podcast somewhere else, you probably have an affinity for food and drink. So that point is probably not wholly lost on you, but it's a really, really important point that food is every bit as culturally important as art, as music, as literature.
Sure enough.
And there's an artistic expression in the whole thing, but then there's also familial ties, there's environmental ties that have shaped our existence forever.
So much.
And it's cultural.
It is indeed, right? So, it is said that you can tell everything about a culture by their religion, their politics, and their food.
Yes.
And the things that that we share across cultural divides, across international divides, is that even without words, without knowing or understanding how to communicate in any other way, you can talk over food. You can share experiences over food. Not as much over drinks because, you know, after a few, I think the conversation might shift a little.
That's true.
But to be fair.
That can be inspirational sometimes. It can be cathartic sometimes.
Oh, I am all about sharing, but... But truthfully, I mean, I've spent entire summers abroad not speaking the language, but we could figure out a way to talk over food.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we won't go down this road where you were asking me questions about some of my favorite food stories growing up and or even just in adult life and connecting to food on a deeper level than just eating and what that meant. And when you just said I spent some time living in Korea, and I don't want to go too far off track here, but when I first got to Korea, I didn't speak the language, go to a local Korean restaurant, everything's written in Korean, and they don't have the little pictures like you will commonly find in an Asian restaurant here.
No, so they're not even Asian restaurants anymore. They're really very American.
Right, and that's a whole other topic of gringoized Chinese food. But I'm going to use that term. I've thrown that around before. But, you know, and so it's just Korean writing, and now there's 10 things on the menu, and I would just point, and I get what I get. Yeah.
There you go. But how fun is that?
That's awesome. It's fantastic.
It and is you, suddenly
like you said,
an adventure.
You learn about the culture that way, right?
Very much so, right? So most folks started off eating what was available. And that's simply because we didn't have shipping that was readily available to everyone. That we didn't have grocery stores that were teeming with produce, and so much so that it always felt as if there was an overflow, that the crops were producing so much every day, every year, that it was just reasonable to have 15,000 apples and, you know, out of 50 varieties.
Right.
You ate what you ate.
I mean, yeah. I mean, now you can go, I think people maybe don't realize this, how crazy, I'll use that term, it is. You can walk into a grocery store, any just a Rouse's around here, a regular standard issue grocery store, if you will, and every third time I walk in there, there is a new varietal of apple that I have never seen before. And that's not a normal pattern, right?
It's not normal. I mean, I understand and I respect the fact that the farmers themselves are actually doing a lot of work in order to ensure that they're meeting their costs and their bottom line. They're in the business of selling food. And so if you want an apple that, you know, kind of tastes like grapes, then we will use our food scientists to create that for you. I mean, I didn't really know how to feel about the grape that tastes like cotton candy.
That's interesting. Okay,
no, it's a thing. It's a thing.
Okay.
And it's a little scary because to me, my cotton candy should taste like cotton candy, and that should not intersect with a grape, but they're
now,
popular.
If somebody can come up with a Brussels sprout that tastes like cotton candy, then I'd probably be... That's just me. That's just me. Sorry, that's my little knock. Me and Brussels sprouts, we don't get along so well, but that's okay.
But they're so cute.
They are. And I know they're good for you and all that. All right. Anyway, so let's do this, Pepper, if you can. Can we take a little break here on the show?
Certainly.
And we're going to come back and we're going to get more into the concept of food policy, what that means to you, and maybe give you some things to actually think about when you're out shopping, dining, and enjoying food. And it's not going to be bad news or unfun. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street, or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. As you know, we are sitting here at, I like to say this, SoFab, here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm only going to do that once, Pepper, during the show.
As many times as you like.
Thank you. We're not watching some British sitcom. It's actually really fabulous here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen, who's the director of the Culinaria program. And we're talking about food policy, Pepper. And it's an important issue. And I think maybe defining it for people to understand a little bit better about what food policy means. Can you explain that? I think maybe people might just think it's regulation or something. And it's not
not trying to deregulate food. So policy in every arena is the unspoken law. It is the way in which our lawmakers treat and handle things, whether that be on a local to an international level. It is how we decide that any decision needs to be made. So, as a policy initiative, we may decide that it makes sense that we would give preference to urban farmers to take over abandoned plots. We could also decide that it makes sense that we maybe fill our coffers with money from developers to buy those plots instead. These are policy decisions. So it's not written anywhere that henceforth we shall not. Right. But it is simply the way that we approach things. So
there's a political will that needs to be connected to this.
Absolutely.
To a degree.
Absolutely.
Zoning decisions.
True enough.
Legislative decisions, that sort of thing.
Right. And so that's the law, right? Mm-hmm. So your zoning is based upon some sort of a written and established and articulated law or guideline that is really the way that we identify whether we are working within the constructs of what we as a society have deemed as acceptable, as opposed to outside of it. Mm-hmm. So guerrilla gardening, for instance, just springs to mind, and that was super popular back in the early 21st century, and we were hearing about folks, especially in Southern California, who were taking over not only abandoned plots, but also they don't call them neutral grounds. What do they call them?
Yeah, center dividers and things like in the middle of the roads.
Thing?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Neutral ground sounds cooler. So
okay.
We'll just
well,
go
good, because
we'll
that's what I
that.
Know. All yeah. right. So so neutral grounds and the areas along the sidewalk where they were just planting food. And anybody who needed it or wanted it could just take as much as they needed. And, you know, this as a policy initiative seems reasonable, right? So this is how we want to ensure that everyone in our space, all of our people, no matter how you got here, that you have enough to eat, right? Mm-hmm. So this is just a baseline. We want to make sure that you have it. However, it was against all sorts of zoning regulations, as in you cannot have growing of food on this particular space. Or worse than that, it's trespassing because the vacant plot is vacant, but it's not unowned, as in it belongs to someone else, and you just can't go and put your fig tree in the middle of the lot. So that's the whole idea of food law and policy. So whether it is that you think of food as a taxable item, so think imports, whether you're taxed at one rate versus another, whether you think of food as contractual, whether you have contracted to purchase a chicken versus a hen, actual case law where there are lots of discussion about what makes a chicken versus what makes a hen. Anyway.
Right. Right.
No, it makes a lot of sense.
Or if you think of it as trademark, for instance, we were talking about $20 Pinots. And so when you start thinking about wine and the labels that go on the outside of those are all trademarks, and that's intellectual property.
Right.
Even folks who may have come up with some new or novel, is the way the Copyright Office defines it, a novel way to present a recipe, those things are all intellectual property. And so food has actually been identified as a thing that is not only legislatable, but it's also a contingent topic of litigation. Mm-hmm. Now we're just getting to a space where food law is being identified as an item in and of itself. So instead of dealing with someone, for instance, on a business transaction who may really have no clear understanding of why you would talk about the difference between a chicken and a hen, you can actually talk to somebody who clearly understands that. And so we get through a conversation a lot faster, mm-hmm. and we can just get to the point of dealing with the actual issue, as opposed to you spending 3 hours convincing me that there really is. Yeah, right. And these are all billable hours.
Convincing
me that there really is a difference between a chicken and a hen. And if I contract with you for a chicken, that I do mean a whole chicken and not chicken nuggets, not chicken breasts, not parts of the chicken, but the actual chicken.
The chicken.
But ready to eat and not live. You know, it's complicated. But again, it's just about a specialization.
So we're moving to a point then that where the conversation is being had around understanding the resource, if you will, better, the environmental component. Well, I think we're having these conversations in other areas of the
Absolutely.
Environment where we're understanding the natural resource and trying to, we're terrible at this as a species, but trying to understand an intrinsic value in the resource in and of itself and being left in place. So what is the intrinsic value of not chopping down a tree versus an intrinsic value or value, a market value of chopping down a tree to build a house? And I think it's a tricky question. I think we're finally starting to have these questions in legal centers in some regard.
A bit, right? So these are, yes, they are certainly environmental law questions, but they're also land use questions.
Right.
And there are, and when I say environmental law, I'm thinking about waste, right? So let us just say, for the sake of argument, you happen to have housing stores with a lot of blighted houses. This happens nowhere I know. Anyway, if you've decided that you want to clear cut, 100-year-old oak trees in order to build something that's new and fancy and modern because we need to attract new people, well, that goes to a cultural shift and a cultural difference, right? So not necessarily policy or law, but what do we as a people deem as acceptable? Does it make sense to us as a people to clear-cut 100-year-old oaks? We know how we feel about our oak trees, right? Do we tear down those trees in order to put a house when you could easily renovate one that's already in existence?
Right.
Right? Or even if you don't renovate it, as a culture, do we decide that it's all right to level it, right? So you level a house that's been there since 1865. Do we think that's okay? And then put in, a McMansion. Is that cool? When we start talking about commercial value, it is really dependent upon, unfortunately, the highest bidder. So whether it is the developer who's coming in with a new apartment complex and wanting to build it in a space that is already occupied by something and can pay whatever it is that the current owner, whether that be the city or a private owner, is calling for or asking for. I don't necessarily like that, but there are a lot of laws on the books I don't like, and there's really just nothing to do about it. The way that we we assess value, I think, is slightly skewed, and this is very theoretical for me, right? So, you know, put on your black beret and break out your cigarettes. We don't assess value based upon the things that will sustain us long term. We assess value based upon what we can turn for a dollar right now. So instead of understanding that we really should be doing something in order to protect our coastline,
right,
we are moving forward with the Bayou pipelines.
Right.
And
yeah, well, and that gets, you know, and we're going to take a break here in just a second, Pepper, and come back. And that kind of gets to the point, two things that I want to come back to, or one finish up on now, come back to, is leave the intrinsic value of leaving a resource in its place. And I think that we're starting to maybe slightly have a conversation
some
about
that. Some of us have been having those conversations for decades,
absolutely,
right? But I mean, these were the tree huggers and the phys ed majors back in the 70s that people thought were nuts. These are the people who hang out in trees and say, you know, aren't cutting us down because it's a value.
Right.
These are the people who are out there on the front lines and willing to be labeled as crazy.
Let's do this, because I used to be one of those people. So, hey, we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drake Show. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen, director of the Culinaria Program. Come on back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. A crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint. And it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Philosophical Nola Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. We're chatting with Pepper Bowen, who is the director of the Culinaria Program. We're talking some of these broader scope ideas of food policy, environmental resources, ecology, and the point that I was making about this debate about having an intrinsic value for a resource, leaving it in place. And, you know, maybe something that we can look at here in New Orleans as we look at, say, the French Quarter. And if we were to raise the French Quarter, R-A-Z-E, the French Quarter, that has a huge value by not doing anything to it and replacing it with strip malls. Oh. Right. And so that's an obvious example, but I think as we push in other directions, and this was the point that I was trying to make before, that sometimes these things may not seem quite as obvious that these resources have a value. But the other thing, Pepper, that we were talking about is we were talking about food policy, and we talked about the legislative component, and that mm-hmm. you explained that, and I think that makes some sense to probably most people. But and if it didn't, the way you explained it, now it makes sense to them. I'm kidding. But the idea with the cultural identity of sure. food policy, maybe that's a part that people maybe don't quite understand, that decision making yeah. has a significant cultural component.
Right. So, yikes. When I said earlier that all you know about who you are is past you on a plate, that is absolutely accurate, right? So if you think to yourself on a random Monday, what are you sitting down to eat? If you're from New Orleans, you are sitting down to a pot of red beans and rice. Yeah. And, you know, if your parents were super fancy, you might have some meat on the side of that. And that would range anywhere from a roast to a chicken or a piece of sausage, right? But historically, there are sort of deviations around what that meat was. If you are from, say, Omaha, chances are you are not eating red beans and rice. If you are from the Northeast Corridor, again, this is not something necessarily that you will eat. And so it's not to say that red beans and rice is the indicator that you are or have a food culture. What it is to say is that everything that goes into your red beans and rice is also an indicator of your culture. So whether it is that you put the full-on Trinity, right, and even the Trinity itself has derivations depending upon whether your family is from Southeast or Southwest Louisiana.
Explain to people who don't know what the Trinity is in the most basic form.
Who doesn't know what?
Well, because the people that are from outside this area listening to the podcast, they're thinking, how do we go to church here all of a sudden? I mean, that's where the name comes from. But go.
Well, yeah. And I don't know why. Anyway, so the Trinity. The Trinity is a trio of sort of seasoning vegetables that go into or are the core, the root of most Louisiana cooking.
Right.
So whether it is that you use celery, onions, and bell pepper will indicate that you are from Southeast Louisiana. If you use garlic, bell pepper and garlic, onions, and celery will let you know that you're from Southwest Louisiana. These are just the things that make it taste good. Mm-hmm. So historically speaking, we didn't have a whole lot of, seasoned salts and things that would just, you could shaky and things all of a sudden would taste a lot better. Thank you, Doritos. Anyway. What we used to do is actually cook stuff, and we would cook stuff that didn't intrinsically have a lot of flavor on its own, right? So we did a lot of slow cooking. We did a lot of braising. We did a lot of cooking over a hearth or a fire that took hours in order to actually develop a flavor palette and some sort of taste to it, right? And so these were things that grew naturally in the area, and so these are the things that we used. For red beans and rice, some people, so talking specifically about the Trinity for New Orleans or Southeast Louisiana, when we're talking bell peppers, onions, and celery, some people use all three, some people use two out of the three, and it really depends upon how it is that you like your red beans as to what's going into them. Go to different parts of town, you'll find folks who use pickle meat, and whether that pickle meat is pork or their families are fancy and they're going into pickled turkey necks. If you don't do pickled turkey necks, if they are boiled turkey necks, the pickle on the other, like, generally gives it a sort of tangy flavor to it. And then in other parts of town, you'll find ham hocks, right? So you would have actually had the knuckle joint from the pig's foot that would go into it. If your family was either a landowner or you had tons of money, you might have put in like a ham shank. But the point of the matter is that every part of town, just like every part of the state and every part of the country, has its own way of cooking things. So even if something is simple, right? So this is probably something that's probably more tangible for a lot of people. Down here, we put ketchup on French fries. In the north, in some places, they put mayonnaise on French fries.
Right.
And we find that horrific.
Right, right.
But that's cultural.
Right. Now, we're looking for two things here, right? One, there's the practicality, as you said, of what's available in our sure. the way we used to do things, right? What's available in our backyard, what's available, what's grown locally, what is raised locally. Mm-hmm. And there's that part. So there's the practical part of this. And then there's the part where we're trying to achieve a desired outcome of what something tastes like. Right. We're not mm-hmm. we're not devoid of emotion. And even in times past, people wanted it to taste good. And that's going to have a cultural identity from what your heritage may be.
Sure.
Where your family came from, if sure. you emigrated from somewhere.
Yeah.
Right.
What your palate will accept and what it won't. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even when you start thinking about the soldiers who came back from Korea, suddenly there was this call for peppers and things, whereas a lot of folks had not been putting spices into their foods. At one point, spaghetti and meat sauce was considered an exotic dish, mm-hmm. and it was only something that Italians ate. And so regular people, which is really fascinating to me because yeah. this happened, like, say, the 60s or so, early to mid-60s, is that people were actually still serious about Italian food being very different and new and very different from anything that they knew or understood. Mm-hmm. Here in New Orleans, I mean, we had Italians, we had Irish, we had Africans, and it became sort of a melange of everyone's cooking for a number of reasons. Some of them were more pleasant and palatable and happy to talk about than others.
And ingredients that were effective in making it happen, too,
sure.
right, that you could get here.
Yeah. Even the gumbo itself, right? So the Native Americans were using sassafras ages upon ages ago. The Africans were cooking something that was akin to a gumbo, and which is I want to say that okra, that gumbo is the name for okra in one of the African languages,
African, yep.
right? Over time, the folks who were more interested in fishing, right? So they were shrimpers and crabbers and folks like that, even hunters, they brought, whether they were Italian or French Canadian, they were putting what they had or that was readily available to them into the pot. Even those folks who were here in, say, New Orleans in the summertime, there was a whole different gumbo mm-hmm. that may have taken tomatoes as opposed to an okra. And in some houses, you can put filet, which is the sassafras
yep.
With okra. In some places, that's simply a no-no because they're both thickeners and it's too much. Honestly, these are all of the things that you know about yourself, right? So whether it is that you think that in order to make a cake, you have to have a pound of butter and a pound of sugar and a pound of eggs, or you need a box from Duncan Hines, that's cultural. Mm-hmm. Whether it is that you know and you understand that on Sunday that you need to, or Saturday you need to start prepping for dinner on Sunday because you got to have fried fish and greens and all sorts of things because you've got family coming over and even the preacher might be stopping by, so you need to have some fried chicken, that's all cultural. The whole idea of whether you are actually cool with the kale and quinoa and some of the new shishi poopoo ideas of what's healthy, all of those things are cultural or devoid of culture, but that's a different conversation.
Right, right. And that exactly. And that's an important difference there, too. Let's do this. In perfect timing, we're going to take a break here, come back and do one last segment with you. And Pepper, one of the things that we're gonna have you on the show on a regular basis moving forward. So there's a whole laundry list of things that we want to talk about. Yeah, you. And we're going to have you back on. So, I mean, I've got this list here of things that we're not going to get to today. And I'm just going to set people up for future shows. So you're going to have to tune in later. We're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, friends. Come on back.
Black head of sun, Bobby Charles Cole, blue. Catholic church bells told the Louisiana blues.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and we are chatting with Pepper Bowen, who is the director of Culinaria, and it is a food policy program. And this is where, as I said, we're going to have Pepper back on in the future to talk about different things. One of the things that we will talk about in the show in the very near future is the disconnect that we have with food. And we've touched on it a little bit. But what I want to say just to tee up this next part of the conversation, I think we can all kind of imagine what it is that I'm saying is that we've moved into this world of grocery stores, industrial agriculture, and these things, and the idea that, you know, the food product comes from somewhere else. Now, the magic, exactly. And now we have these ideas and certain programs that are trying to be put in place to, say, urban farming, and we touched on that a little bit as well. We talked about the legislative component, Pepper, of that and how we understanding that there's zoning and other things that have to happen. But there's a cultural identity part of that process, too, that has to happen as well for people to accept it, right? And create the acceptance of it and the political will to make it happen.
Right, and so that's really back to your intrinsic value, right? So, especially post-Katrina, there was not a whole lot that was left in town, and a lot of the blighted properties or even demolition by dereliction, that there wasn't anything around. And so there was a movement of folks who were coming in, whether they were coming in order to teach or they were coming because they wanted to help rebuild or whatever the case might happen to be. Many of them decided that they were going to be farmers. Now, the thing is that I say that not lightly, because there's no one who's ever rolled over on a Monday morning and said to them, you know what I want to do is to become an urban farmer. There's actually, right. There's a lot of thought that goes into what that means. And the act of growing your own food is suddenly an act of resistance, that you are opting out of the larger system of commercialism, that you are trying to, very much like the slow food movement, that you are trying to go back to something that is a slower, more sustainable view of the world, that we aren't completely dependent upon bananas that come from South America or tomatoes that may come in from California or Florida, that we have those things right here, that it makes more sense for us to grow them here and to not just produce them and sell them, but to consume them here than it does to bring them in from outside of this area. The land ownership becomes a huge issue, especially when you start talking about farming, because it is something that takes years in order to not only ensure that the land is actually going to give the fruit or vegetable, whatever the produce is that you're growing, what it needs in order to sustain you as a person.
Adequate space, right?
Mm. Adequate space is necessary. Water is a huge thing. A lot of people don't think about the fact that you need water in order to irrigate the crops until suddenly you don't have water, and where you put in this water meter. It's, you know, all of a sudden very, very complex. But the intrinsic value of having urban farms and urban gardens where everyone can participate, where kids can go and where adults can go and see what cotton looks like or hibiscus looks like, or even taste what raspberries right off the bush actually taste like, as opposed to what it is that we sell often in grocery stores, which is off season, right?
So, and picked green, right? Picked green to survive shipping and so on.
And then it ripens in the truck along the way. we have moved away from living and eating with the seasons so that we understand that tomatoes are a summer food, right? That's why we've got the Creole Tomato Fest when it happens.
Right.
That we do, and, you know, oysters should be eaten in the winter because you crack them open now and they are full and they are just gorgeous. We've moved away from that because we decided along this path, right? So it's not one decision, it's several decisions that got us here, that we wanted to have tomatoes in the dead of winter.
I want what I want, when I want it now.
Absolutely. Yeah. That I want to have the things that I can't get anywhere else, and I want them all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, commercialism being what it is, give the customer what they want. Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about growing things local, I think it's important to understand that we do have farmers who are here who are willing to grow those things, who are willing to supply, who not only want to be in grocery stores, who will not only sell at farmers markets, but who are, you know, also if they had any alternative, would be happy to sell on the street corners, mm-hmm. just to sell fresh. I think that a lot of us have gotten to a point where we don't recognize that it's a big deal for the guy to sit outside of the university uptown with a truck full of satsumas coming up from Belchase because we can get them in the grocery store. Now, even if those satsumas don't come from Belchase, I still have satsumas, but I'm not contributing to my region, right? So my dollars are not going back to support my area. I'm also not purchasing locally, which then encourages more folks to get into the business of producing food and to utilize the stuff that we already have here. I personally don't understand why we do a lot of the stuff that we do.
Fair enough. That's a great point. And I think, and that's sort of what I wanted to get at here, or as we're getting at here, is the educational component, the experiential component, Pepper, that you're talking about, to me, exposing kids, just using that as an example, in an urban farm setting to understand the seasonal cyclical nature of agriculture, mm-hmm. then creates that awareness and creates that understanding that then creates the cultural identity and then creates the political will in an ideal world.
Well, no, it's not ideal. I think that's exactly the way that it works, right? So if you have... there's no reason to change stuff that ain't broken.
Sure.
Right? So I don't ever wake up in the morning and decide that I'm just going to do something that doesn't impact me. It is not until it is in my backyard, until it's reaching me on a personal level, until there's something that has intersected my little life that's made me so uncomfortable that suddenly now I want for things to change. When Uber was in Northern California, we didn't care about it until it hit here. When Airbnb was in the Northeast Corridor, we didn't care about it until it hit here. These are things that now are huge issues because they are in our back door, and mm-hmm. that's always the way that it works.
Mm-hmm. And that's local politics, that's local dialogue, and that's really important. Those are excellent analogies because I think that's it. As we look here in New Orleans, and I think a lot of people are looking at, again, we're just using this example of urban farming in these other places, that you might, oh, urban farming sounds like a great idea. We're going to plant a rooftop garden in downtown San Jose in California because that's Silicon Valley and that's what they do.
Right.
And then people don't really, it maybe sounds like a great idea to you, or maybe sounds like a tree hugging hippie idea to you. But until it actually happens here, then people have to understand what the ramifications are, the decision making, what the outcomes are, and what it potentially means to culture and society.
Absolutely.
Large.
I mean, there was a rooftop garden, a hydroponic garden that went into a grocery store in the CBD a couple years back.
Yeah.
And we were all super excited about that, and then all of a sudden nobody cared anymore because, well, now this is the normal. This is norm, right? This is where they come from, the roof. people stop paying attention. It's no longer in the cycle, in the news cycle.
We've already got one of those. We've checked that box.
Precisely. Right. And it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing is that we do have so many people who are still bent on having lawns, which serve no purpose whatsoever, and in New Orleans are difficult to come by. So why we even want them, I don't know. But, you know, just even if, right? So certainly not that you would grow enough food in order to sustain yourself and your family, because that is a difficult thing to do. But even if you just put in a little square box, just a foot, where you can plant some stuff and see that it grows. Maybe then we can get people to understand that not all fruit comes out pretty, right? Right. So we have so much food waste just because a cucumber is a little crooked or
has a little bruise somewhere or something.
Right.
Right.
Or like the carrot has an extra hump on it and is like, oh, it's weird, which is true, but it's still a carrot. And my God, once you cook it, nobody knew.
It still tastes good.
Right. It's still a carrot.
Still makes your eyesight better. Well, Pepper, we got about 30 seconds left or so before. Can you tell people where they can find Culinaria online, do some reading and all of that? Where's the website?
Sure. We are www.culinariacenter.org. And you can find all of the brilliant things that I opine over weekends at that website.
Wonderful. Awesome. And here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, Aretha Castle Haley, what's the address here?
We are 1504 Aretha Castle Haley, and the Culinary Innovation Center kitchen, rather, is 1809 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Yes,
so
awesome.
You can only come in the front door, though.
Okay, cool. Good. So let's do this, friends. We are going to, we're going to actually close out the show here. Pepper, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we're going to certainly have Pepper on again in the near future. And she's going to have some exciting news about ways you can hear her more coming up pretty soon. So, friends, we're going to sign off here on the NOLA Drink Show. Be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all.